We follow President Trump's tariffs on metal imports, big penalties to fix a trading system the White House regards as broken. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. We've been hearing from economists who are looking askance at the Trump administration's 25% tariff on all imported steel and a 10% levy on all imported aluminum. From the EU to China, there's already measured talk of retaliation, and analysts fret about a trade war, if it comes to that, having unpredictable effects. Tariffs could hurt profits in industries that use the metal, and consumers could also pay more. But steelworkers have had enough of what they say is cheating on international trade rules. Leo Gerard studied economics and, by some accounts, once talked about becoming an econ professor before becoming a steelworker. Gerard is the president of the United Steelworkers Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we've often noted on this program that 84,000 U.S. workers, not just in steel, but in all metal, have lost their jobs in the last decade, given these trading conditions. Yet you saw steel-using industries, including the car industry, are freaking out about these tariffs. Where do you come down on this announcement?
Let me back you up a bit. Way more than 80,000 workers have lost their jobs. In fact, 60,000 factories have closed since 2012. And the minor increase in price, if it happens at all, will be minimal. We checked out, we weighed a can and put it against the price of aluminum. If anything, it would come out to 0.1 cent per can.
We heard from Budweiser that that's going to put up the price of beer, for instance, and you're saying not really?
No, it's factually not true. But let me say this. In 15 years, China went from 500 million tons of steel to 1.2 billion tons of steel. Over that period of time, there were five what they call high-level meetings to get China to play by market conditions. Now we have 500 million tons of excess steel capacity just from China floating around the world and being dumped. And what we encourage the president to do is to bring the cheaters in line. We're not necessarily enamored with the broad brush approach. We think we ought to go after what we euphemistically call the evildoers.
You don't sound like you're in the mood to let the World Trade Organization just handle this moving forward. Stay within the rules. Do you think the time is now for these tariffs imposed by the White House?
We've been working with OECD, WTO, high-level government meetings for 15 years. During that period of time, China was overproducing steel. In each one of those consultations, China promised the American consultants that they would reduce their capacity. China has broken the promise every one of those five consultations. And this last year, they produced 1.23 billion tons of steel, which puts almost 5.5 to 6 million tons of steel out on the market, depressing prices and depressing capacity. And in order to stay in business, we've got facilities that are shut down. And so we're really just saying that we'll support playing by the rules.
Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers Union, speaking from Pittsburgh. Note that the White House announcement was not attached to policy specifics yesterday. Those plans are due next week. The energy company BP must have some kind of time machine because its latest energy outlook looks at what the world will produce and what we'll use way out to the year 2040. That's when a baby born today turns 22. Spencer Dale is BP's chief economist. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'm just going to guess, if we're looking out at energy consumption for these United States of America, and you're looking over many decades, I'm thinking it must be quintupling. Even more. I mean, energy consumption in the U.S. must skyrocket in the coming years. No?
No. Quintupling. That's a great word. No. It's broadly flat in countries like the United States and other developed economies like the U.K., Europe. And the argument there is the economy keeps growing, and so that generates more activity. But the machines we use, the cars we drive, get more and more efficient. And those two things broadly net off. So all the growth of energy demand in the world is coming from fast-growing developing economies, China and India.
So interesting. So it makes a difference when a new refrigerator is more energy efficient or someone is using a hybrid car. In the aggregate, it adds up for the United States.
Hugely efficient. So one statistic, just to get your arms around this, is we think the number of miles traveled by cars around the world will double, but the amount of oil needed to do that will stay broadly the same. The cars just get more and more efficient.
Now, energy production in the United States, that's what's going up in the coming decades.
Absolutely. And this is really important for the United States. So its demand for oil has been declining quite significantly over the last 10 years and carry on declining. But at the same time, the United States production of oil, particularly U.S. shale oil and U.S. shale gas, is growing more and more. The U.S. is likely to emerge as by far and away the world's largest producer of both oil and natural gas.
Now, one of the findings you've highlighted in this report is that the energy market globally is going to be much more competitive. What do you mean by that?
Well, sort of three things which is going. Energy demand continues to grow, but it grows less quickly. So that demand side is more competitive. Lots of competition within fuels. That's the second one. So U.S. tight oil or U.S. shale oil competing against OPEC. The third one, lots of competition across fuels. We're thinking we're going to get to a world where the world's fuel mix is the most diversified we've ever seen, with oil, gas, coal, and non-fossil fuels, each providing around a quarter of the world's oil. If you've got all those energy sources competing against each other, that makes for a far more competitive global marketplace.
Now, some people listening will hear that you're from BP and wonder if you're understating that one quarter that is the renewable part of this. That's what you think the mix is going to be in the coming years, a quarter?
So for non-fossil fuels, in total, that includes hydropower and nuclear as well. For renewables, we have it growing from about 4% today to 14% by 2040. Now, you'll say, well, 14%, that doesn't sound very much. That growth from 4% to 14%, if renewables can grow at that rate, that would be the fastest growth that any energy has grown ever in history. So I am extraordinarily optimistic on renewable energy. BP's an energy company. We want to provide the energy of the future. If that's renewable energy, fine. Let's go and produce a renewable energy.
And you can draw a pretty straight line between the growth in non-fossil fuels in this mix and, in theory, reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that's getting out into the atmosphere.
Yes. And the story in our energy outlook is carbon emissions are growing less quickly than they were before. That's good news. The bad news is they're continuing to grow. And any sort of analysis consistent with hitting those goals we all saw agreed to in Paris means they need to fall very sharply. And so a message from the energy outlook is we still need to do an awful lot more if we're going to get those carbon emissions coming down like we all hope to see them do.
So it's going to go to 14%. But if you're really focused on the carbon, maybe that percentage, the world has to figure out a way to get that percentage higher.
Exactly. How can we generate two things, I think. One is how can we get renewable energy growing higher? And also, how can we lead to a sort of cleaner, lower carbon fuel mix more generally? So a shift away from coal into natural gas. That's a key thing we're seeing around the world. That also has huge benefits because the carbon emissions associated with natural gas are roughly half that associated with coal.
Now, the present U.S. administration is a fan of fossil fuel, wants to keep coal very much in the mix. Are you seeing the early effects of domestic U.S. policy in the longer-term energy trends?
I think it's still early days. I think the key point here in the U.S., we've seen natural gas over the last few years gain significant share relative to coal. What was driving that predominantly was not policies, it was economics. The growth of lots and lots of low-cost natural gas generated by shale gas just meant that gas was able to compete against coal, particularly in producing power, and that caused coal to be crowded out, and importantly, led to significant carbon reductions as well in the US.
That's interesting. So it was economics, less so policy.
Absolutely. This is an economic-driven thing.
BP's chief economist Spencer Dale, the BP Energy Outlook 2018 edition is now available for your weekend reading pleasure. We put a link at marketplace.org if this is your thing. Our executive producer is Nicole Childers. Our digital producer, Janet Wynn. Our engineer is Brian Allison. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.